You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Barrett. It's a tough time to be a sports fan, and it's anybody's guess as to when games may return. We're talking about how we get our fix in the meantime with a columnist and Badger alum. Tune in for a conversation about the state of sports coming up. Now, the legal fight over Governor Tony Evers' safer at home order is ramping up. Evers yesterday asked the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to dismiss a Republican legal challenge to the order. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald are leading the lawsuit. They said last week that the head of the State Department of Health Services, who's been point on the state's response to coronavirus, had czar-like powers. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's here to catch us up and put everything into context. Sean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Keeley.
Take us back then. Remind us, what's the rationale for the state Republicans' challenge to this current safer at home order?
Essentially, they are saying that the Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm, who has issued some of the most sweeping orders during this pandemic, including both safer at home orders, that she went beyond her authority as a member of the executive, and that the governor's office, the governor's administration, can't issue orders like these without getting the legislature's okay first. The way they want to do that is they want her to issue, well, first of all, they want this stay-at-home order extension overturned, and they want future stay-at-home orders to be issued through, you know, what's known as the administrative rules process, where essentially an agency creates these rules. They run them through the legislature, and it gives lawmakers veto power over whether or not those rules ever take effect.
What did we hear from Governor Evers' office in response to the Republican suit yesterday?
The brief from the governor's office basically said that if you do this, if you put it in the administrative rulemaking process, that it is going to be an especially cumbersome process, basically, that when you're dealing with addressing a pandemic, time is of the essence. And so some of the orders that Andrea Palm issued were, you know, we heard that they were thinking about doing it, and then a couple days later they did it. And they said that it was based on the way they saw this disease spreading and the knowledge of how quickly it spreads. And so that was their basis for issuing these safer-at-home orders. If they'd had to go through the rulemaking process, the governor's office is saying that takes a minimum of weeks. It is not a fast process. And, you know, in this case, we kind of know that the end result, if they were to promulgate those rules and go through the legislature, we know that the legislature doesn't like the plan that they've come up with, which is a statewide stay-at-home order. Republicans have been talking about for a while that they want a regional approach, and so if they want a regional approach, that's not what DHS ordered. And so not only would this have to go through kind of a cumbersome process, the governor's office is saying, you know what the end result would be. And that could, you know, that could be kind of treacherous during a pandemic.
On the surface, though, is the law clear about this question of whether Evers should have gone through the legislature, or is there room to argue those different positions?
We've got a lot of arguing going on, so I guess there's room. I mean, there have been a lot of amicus briefs filed in this case already from groups with a stake in it, everybody from constitutional law scholars to healthcare providers to unions, conservative groups, businesses. They're all weighing in on this. So, I guess lots of arguing going on. If you look at the law itself, there is a law. I would say most of us probably didn't know about this law like before any of this happened, but there is a law that carves out powers for the Department of Health Services to address communicable diseases, and it gives the DHS secretary pretty broad authority to do some of the things that she has done, you know, close schools, close churches, close public gatherings. The language is so broad that DHS is saying we're doing exactly what this law spells out. The legislature is saying, okay, but you still have to put that, you still have to bring those proposals to us in the legislature.
So there's potential that this public health emergency could bolster the legal powers that Evers and DHS Secretary Andrea Palm actually have on the books already.
Well, I mean, the essentially, if the court upholds Evers, then yeah, it's going to say that everything you've done so far and everything that DHS has done so far is okay. And so that would give them the power to continue doing that as this pandemic progresses. The court has a 5-2 conservative majority. The court's been pretty sympathetic to a lot of lawsuits or cases brought by the legislature, and particularly cases that argue that the legislature needs more power in disputes with the governor or the executive. So, you know, I think there's a decent chance that that could be what happens here.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, and we are talking about what's happening legally in front of the state Supreme Court over Wisconsin's current extended stay-at-home, safer-at-home order. And Sean, help us understand some of the possible outcomes of this legal challenge. If they rule in favor of the Evers administration, what happens? And the opposite, too, if they rule in favor of the Republican lawmakers, suddenly does the state open up?
So if they rule in favor of the Evers administration, the current Safer at Home order is set to expire on May 26th. And the governor has said could be sooner than that, could be later than that. I mean, this is not our first stay-at-home order. Mm-hmm. So there's the possibility that if the governor's administration has the power to issue additional orders, they will, depending on what's happening. If Republicans win, what they asked the court to do was to issue a 6-day stay. Essentially keep everything frozen for 6 days to give the governor's office time to issue administrative rules, get it through the legislature, essentially to give time for lawmakers and the governor to come up with a compromise. Evers' office is saying 6 days is not enough if we have to do these through rules, but that's what Republicans are asking for. So if they can't reach a compromise, what happens then? You know, I mean, because they seem pretty entrenched. They're, you know, they seem like they're kind of far apart. What could happen is that you could have a 72-county situation where some counties have stay-at-home orders, some counties do not. And so that could be sort of like this regional approach that Republicans have been talking about, but they wouldn't ever have to actually end up passing anything or do anything or agree to anything with the governor. If they can't agree, it could fall to locals to deal with COVID-19.
Hmm. Sean, when are we going to know what the state Supreme Court has to say about this?
So Republicans or, you know, the legislature has until tomorrow to file a response brief to what the governor filed yesterday. And then it's in the court's hands, basically. Do they want to take this case or not? I mean, that's essentially the first question they have to ask is whether they want to hear this. And then, you know, they kind of set their own timeline for how to respond to this stuff. They can move very quickly when they want to. I mean, you think about that case that we had on April 6th when the governor tried to use a different set of emergency powers to stop or postpone in-person voting for the April 7th election. The court, you know, stopped him within 4 hours. They've decided not to do that in this case. So they're already taking longer with this challenge. And we don't know how long that they will decide to take. It is noteworthy, I think, that the court has addressed COVID-19 in other ways. They suspended suspended jury trials until May 22nd. So it's not like this court is denying the public health threat of COVID-19. We just haven't seen how they're going to address this particular law and this issue with the governor and the legislature.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. Before we let you go, Sean, I want to turn to another story that broke today. Evers is the Department of Administration Secretary has said agencies, state agencies should cut their budgets. What do we know? What do we need to know about that right now?
Yeah, it sounds like there's like a 5% operating budget cut. The governor said today that's going to amount to about a $70 million savings. You know, that's money. But if you look at the overall state budget, it's about $84 billion over 2 years when you take into account state and federal funding. And we know that the governor has said in a letter to the Trump administration that because of COVID-19 and the revenue shortfalls brought about by, you know, what we're going through right now, state could have a $2 billion hole. So $70 million isn't nothing, but there are, you know, deeper cuts ahead possibly.
We'll have to see how those play out. Sean, thank you so much for catching us up on everything.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson updating us on the legal fight over the governor's extended safer at home order and a quick take on the news that state agencies are supposed to cut back spending over budget concerns related to this new coronavirus outbreak. Coming up, a Madison-based children's book author is setting up a virtual reading after her in-person event had to be canceled. That's still to come here on Central Time. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, we're talking with a children's book author who adapted yogic breathing techniques for a quiet time exercise she integrates into live readings. That's just ahead. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg exploring the history of socialism in the upper Midwest.
Wisconsin has a rich history in politics that has influenced many of the nation's major political movements. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look at Wisconsin's connection to socialism.
I grew up hearing how dangerous socialists were. After all, the Cold War against the USSR could turn hot if we didn't root out the communists in our midst, as Joe McCarthy warned. Then, I lived in a socialist Norway, and my wife gave birth to our first baby there. Norwegian healthcare covered the birth and gave us $5,000 to help raise the baby, and would deposit $150 into our bank account every month until our son was 18. This democratic socialist government paid for my year of college in Trondheim, paid our health care, and would pay our pension if we had stayed. These socialists certainly didn't seem so dicey after all. They seemed positively civil. Some American politicians invoke Scandinavian socialism as a model for the U.S., but I suggest we look to Wisconsin. Our state has a long history of alternatives to for-profit corporations in the form of owner-operated cooperatives and profit-sharing credit unions. Milwaukee even elected three socialist mayors. German visionaries in Milwaukee dreamed of a cooperative commonwealth rather than cutthroat capitalism and succeeded in electing socialist mayors that served most of the period between 1910 and 1960. Milwaukee's socialist mayor, Emil Seidel, even lured Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Carl Sandburg to work for him. Wisconsin may have had its share of socialist mayors, but the most influential progressive was likely Thorstein Veblen, born in Cato, Wisconsin, as the son of Norwegian immigrants. He viciously criticized cutthroat American capitalism with his famous warnings of conspicuous consumption. And his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, became the impetus for the Roosevelt Revitalization Package for the U.S., better known as the socialist-leaning New Deal. Baptist minister Lars Jorgensen Hauge witnessed a poor Danish-American woman break down in tears after she was given just 5 cents a pound for her sweet cream butter, and then only in trade at the company store. Hauge remembered the cooperative creameries back in Denmark. So he traveled the Midwest preaching his butter sermons, pushing the farmers to share their wealth with each other by forming cooperatives. The cooperative ideal spread throughout the Midwest and expanded to general stores, food markets, gas and electrical operations, agricultural elevators, and banks as credit unions. These co-ops offer an alternative system that allows all members to have a stake in the greater good rather than working just for the wealthy. Even Midwestern houses, cozy bungalows, came from the populist arts and crafts movement that took its socialist views and applied them to handcrafted houses that were affordable to everyone. Danish landscape architect Jens Jensen brought his progressive ideals to Wisconsin. He died in Ellison Bay when he worked with Frank Lloyd Wright. Gustav Stickley from Osceola, Wisconsin, expanded on the style with his Craftsman magazine that promoted arts and crafts design and socialist equality. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote in 2010 that the socialists delivered, and the public came to expect administrations rooted in honesty, efficiency, frugality, and concern for the working person. They called their fellow citizens to a higher conception of the common good, one that placed cooperation above bare self-interest. This socialist legacy survives here in the upper Midwest with by far the most co-ops of any other area of the country. Apparently, the democratic socialism that we experienced in Norway was here all along.
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Divya Mal lovingly says she was shocked when she heard about young children experiencing stress and anxiety, and to help kids manage their emotions, the Madison-based children's book author drew from her previous experience as a yogic nun. She developed a curriculum for teaching breathing and stretching in what she calls quiet time exercise in an educational setting. She's added that practice to readings she does of her book, Happy Leaf. Divya was supposed to do a reading this week at the DeForest Area Public Library, but it was canceled because of the coronavirus outbreak. The reading, though, is going forward online. And to tell us more about her work, we have Divya on the line now. Divya, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Hi there. Let's first talk briefly about what quiet time exercise or QTE really is.
Quiet time exercise. It's an educational stress management program for students and teachers and parents and everyone. But I introduced it in San Antonio, Texas in 1990.
And how do you see it helping children manage stress? How does it work?
Well, I start with some stretching. You know, because especially I customize, like if I deal with young, like 3 and 4 years old preschoolers, then I do a lot of stretching, jumping jack, you know, to just release that energy. And then I do some few of yoga postures. And then after that, I sing some songs with some hand movements, like, good morning, dear earth. Good morning, dear sun. So I move my arms, you know, like the sun, the flowers, you know, and flowers, everyone. And so after the singing, and then I teach them relaxation pose, actually where they lay down. Oh, sorry. After the exercises, then they all lay down and just teach them the diaphragmatic breathing, we call it, or yogic breathing, where they place their hands in their stomach and just really breathing. Because for children, they really breathe naturally, you know. And so I just try to cultivate, you know, keep that diaphragmatic breathing in them. And then we sit in silence for about a minute or two, you know. And then we sing songs. And then after that, you know, it's done. And they really love music, you know, and movement especially. And then we play some songs. So it's really, I've seen in the beginning, it's very challenging because they're not used to it. And
right.
Then doing,
I mean,
like,
you mentioned them. Yeah, no,
then,
I just... You mentioned a moment of a minute of silence with sometimes young children. I mean, that's not usually what they're used to or really paying attention to that breathing. It's just normal for them.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I close the eyes, you could say, you know, 10 seconds. But then the more they do it, then they're able to do it at least half a minute, a minute. And then after about 4 or 5 months, they learn how to just sit still. I mean, even the superintendent was so shocked, you know, because we had a QTE concert, you know, where they perform, the program to their parents, to the public. And so it was like, oh, my God, how did you do that? I said, that's one aspect or benefits of QTE or yoga. I couldn't say yoga at that time because in the 1990s, yoga is, you know, you can't even say yoga, especially in public schools.
Right. People made assumptions at that point, for sure. Your book is called Happy Leaf. How do you incorporate this QTE or this yoga into readings of your book?
Well, when I do my book reading, I say, okay, after I finish my book reading, I say, okay, let's all be happy leaf. You know, she loves to stretch. So I start stretching. I do some body movements, you know, and just, you know, move our body side to side, or we jump, or we shake. Like I said, oh, well, let's shake like a strawberry shake, you know, or a banana shake, you know, something like that. And then after that movement, I sing some songs. I play the guitar and then sing some songs. And then after that, then I hand out like a couple pages of coloring pages of Happy Leaf. Then I, you know, where I distribute the coloring pages and then they color it. So I incorporate, it's not just a book reading. I incorporate movement, music, and art.
Which kind of feeds into the point of your story, right? Part of this book's message that about stress management for kids, emphasizing this connection to nature.
Yes, definitely. Because Happy Leaf, you know, she's a Happy Leaf with human traits. She loves being in nature. Like it's the Happy Leaf the book is like she gets this adventure, this journey. As she wakes up, she greets the sun, you know, and then she goes through the day and she connects with, see the water, the river, the butterflies, the trees, the flowers. And she feels so happy because children have this intrinsic connection with nature. They just, you know, like, especially young, you know, 2 or 3 years old, when they see butterflies or blooming flowers, they're like, ah, you know. So it's just so important, especially nowadays, to immerse children in nature, because, you know, they're always, now we're all inside a house, but it's nice to also get out in nature. You know, yeah, we can wear our mask and everything, social distancing, but the nature, they give us, it nourishes our soul, our hearts. It inspires us.
Yes, Divya, thank you so much for joining us. That's Madison-based children's book author Divya Ma Lovingly. Talk to her today about a virtual reading she's doing of her book, Happy Leaf. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 o'clock on The Morning Show, we're making cooking a social experience. Our guest says you don't have to be an expert chef to make it happen. We've got a private chef joining us to offer suggestions to expand our skills in the kitchen. That's from 6 until 9 tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, the National Football League draft happened last weekend, but it looked different than in years before. It was all by video. The league says that 3-day event had an average audience of 15.6 million. That shatters the old draft record set in 2014. And while this draft itself was unique, it's also not like it was up against the stiffest sports competition. COVID-19 concerns have essentially wiped out all other sporting events for the foreseeable future. But there was also the unknown, like how a virtual draft would actually work, with Commissioner Roger Goodell announcing picks from his basement.
Welcome to the 2020 NFL Draft, and thank you for taking the time to be with us. Like millions of fans, team personnel, and prospects, I join you from my home for the first virtual NFL Draft. This is different for us, and it's different for you, because it has to be.
Different is one word for it. Meanwhile, the league is reportedly mulling how it could still play a full season this year. And other sports are wrestling with the same question, including the possibility of holding games with no fans in attendance. Jason Gay is a sports columnist for The Wall Street Journal and a UW-Madison alum. Jason, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Listen, I got nothing better to do. There are no sports. I got plenty of time over here.
I mean, you touched on it, right? How hard is it to write a sports column when you don't really have any sports going on?
You know, I'm being slightly facetious because I think in some respect, this is one of the most exciting, strangely dynamic periods in the history of sports. I mean, when you think about it, everything has stopped. Every league, every level you have a complete shutdown. And then you have, as you mentioned at the top, this whole reconsideration of how you can come back, when you can come back, what your games will look like when you come back. The amount of energy that's being put into re-envisioning these games is going to reshape sports for quite a long time, I think. So though there aren't the kinds of things that we're accustomed to, scores and fantasy teams and all that kind of stuff, there's a heck of a lot happening right now.
Well, we just talked about the NFL draft. What are your takeaways from that virtual event?
You know, I have to say, I'm, you know, not a big fan of the NFL draft. I find it kind of like, you know, overly stagey and corporate and shiny and ridiculous. I think that's exactly the point, and it's quite a popular thing. I don't mean to sound like I'm, you know, the prevailing opinion here. I found this version of it by far the best. I just found the folksy aspects of it, the fact that Roger Goodell, as you said, I mean, literally in his basement, not a joke, in his basement, the players at their homes with very, very small groups of loved ones, Bill Belichick's dog riding shotgun during the later rounds in the draft. I just found those kinds of personal touches very much antithetical to the way that the NFL is very corporate and slick sometimes. And I just found it great. I mean, it was some of the best press the NFL has gotten as an organization in quite a long time. So I think a lot of people agree with us. And listen, those numbers are spectacular. As you mentioned, these were all-time audiences for it. Because, look, sports fans, they're desperate for anything at this point.
Yeah, I mean, do we then consider this a live sporting event again? Did that qualify?
Listen, I mean, considering people are betting on marble races right now, I think we can consider the draft a live sporting event. Sure. The definitions are getting blurrier by the minute.
I have to tell you, I missed out on the marble races until producer Bill Martins mentioned it to me today. I was like, ESPN aired marble races? So I did miss out on that. But I did catch wind of the fact that the NBA decided to run a game of horse competition.
Yes.
What do you want to say here?
It was about as exciting as you'd imagine a game of horse would be. You know, you've played horse, I'm sure, once in a while with a friend or a family member. It's a nice way to pass 20 minutes. It's not terribly compelling television, even if you have superstar players, which they did have. You know, they're looking for everything at this point. If you or I were to come up with some sort of gimmick, we want to race eggs on Zoom, I think they would find a way to buy it.
You know, it strikes me, though, that so much of there's certainly an element of sports that is competition, that is the talent. But so much of sports is personality, is storylines. And right now, even though they're not playing, I mean, major athletes have the opportunity to tell stories, to kind of pull the curtain back so we can see what real life is like for them now. Is there an opportunity here?
I think that's an excellent point. I think, you know, all the time of like, what would this have been like a couple generations ago where you didn't have the kind of technological access, the immediacy that you have today? And the fact that athletes can reach out, whether it's, you know, through video, social media outlets, their own Zoom calls and interviews and things like that. I watched today Chrissy Everett and Martina Navratilova interviewing each other. Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer did the same earlier in the week. It's pretty fascinating stuff, and it is showing a personality and a humanity to athletes that we may not have seen in the past. And then on the other side of it, you have this whole, the biggest sporting event probably the last couple of weeks is this running documentary of Michael Jordan that ESPN is running over 10 parts over the next few weeks. I mean, these are events that happened more than 20 years ago, and yet it's sort of opening up a portal into the things that we love and we miss about the games. And I think it's what's getting people, you know, through these weeks.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist with The Wall Street Journal, and we welcome you to this conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us, how are you getting by without live sports? Are you watching classic games on TV, or have you caught any sort of a substitute sporting event like that NBA horse competition or virtual NASCAR? Maybe you were wrapped by the marble racing. Tell us about it. 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jason, you wrote a column about the White House's panel that is made up of heads of the major sports leagues. Here's what President Trump had to say when unveiling that group earlier this month.
But we have to get our sports back. I'm tired of watching baseball games that are 14 years old.
Oof. What exactly is the mission of this panel?
Listen, I think that there's no question in this country, and we can talk about whether or not it's a good or a bad thing, but that sports are kind of representative of, you know, culture, right? And that sports mean something to people. And the fact that games are being played is going to be enormously meaningful in terms of saying something about our recovery from this situation. The question, though, is when will sports resemble the thing that we loved about them? I think we're a long way off still from the idea of a packed Lambeau Field, a packed Camp Randall. We are quite a ways away from that kind of environment. And I wonder if we will ever get back there. I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful of it. But these ideas that are sort of placeholders like no fans and biodomes and quarantined hotels and things like that, I mean, these are strictly placeholders because these leagues and colleges and even high schools are in the business of seeking revenue, and they need to try to figure out some way to figure out something in the meantime.
There is the revenue aspect of it, but from a fan's perspective, there is the experience. And so when you say, I don't know when, if ever, we'll really get back to a packed Lambeau, I think you raise some eyebrows there.
Well, listen, everybody wants to go to Lambeau. I mean, it's one of the great, great experiences in all of sports, right? From an experience, just from just being there. I just do think there is a question now. Will we see sort of large scale crowds in mass sporting events for quite a while? I mean, this is not something I'm just breaking out here. Every sort of public health expert has talked about this, that, you know, we are a little bit a ways off, or more than a little bit of ways off from a 50, 60, 80,000 seat arena being filled with people sitting shoulder to shoulder. When you think about those kinds of experiences, the things that we loved about them, they kind of run counter to what's prevailing common sense right now.
Right, right. Because part of the fun is celebrating with the people around you, or even experiencing the loss and being able to talk a little bit of smack about the other team with the people who are wearing the same color jersey you are. Like, that's part of the
100%. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we would get back there at some point. But we do have a circumstance where, you know, in the interim, we're going to have this very strange scenario where games may be played without fans. And one thing I wonder about that is the novelty of that going to wear off rather quickly? It'll be cool to see our favorite players and teams out there playing again and playing games that have consequences. But I think we might be underestimating the atmospheric value of a live audience. Even if you're sitting at home watching a game on TV, those fans that are in that stadium, in that arena, give you something back. I really do believe that there's a charge to a live crowd audience around anything. And so I think having that kind of situation where there are no fans in the audience will be deeply strange.
And you can join this conversation with Jason Gay, who's a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, at 800-642-1234. We are wondering how you're getting by without sports. Maybe you're watching some old footage or finding new things to focus on that aren't the traditional sports that you've always watched. You're welcome to call us at 800-642-1234, where there's a line for you, or you can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Jason, you talked about not having fans. I mean, Major League Baseball is reportedly considering starting its season in late June, playing 100 regular season games. You wouldn't have the same kind of leagues. Teams would play in their home stadiums, but in front of no fans. Do you think that can work?
I don't know. is the most honest answer I can give you. I think everybody is committed to coming up with creative ideas to lower risks, to make it feasible to play some version of a schedule. 100 games sounds incredibly ambitious. Playing in home stadiums right now, as we sit here in late April, feels ambitious still. But what you talked about is sort of this regional breakdown now. You're going to put the East Coast teams just squarely playing on the East Coast, Midwest squarely playing in the Midwest, West Coast, and you sort of rearrange the division. It's pretty cool looking. I admire the fact that leagues are kind of shaking up the box and trying to do different things. And I think there's an opportunity for creativity here. But that is also just a proposal at this point, just as it was a couple of weeks ago when baseball was talking about, well, we'll play all the games in Arizona in a couple of stadiums and we'll quarantine all the players. So we're a ways off from seeing players on the field, I think.
All right. Well, we'll continue talking with Jason Gay here about what it's like for sports fans right now as we are navigating new territory and COVID-19 has put almost all sports on hold. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Help us understand how you're getting by. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about living without sports. COVID-19 has put pretty much all sporting events on hold for now. The leagues are figuring out how to salvage their seasons, even the possibility of holding games without fans. And there is still a line for you at 800-642-1234 as we talk with our guest, Jason Gay, a sports columnist with The Wall Street Journal. And Jesse from Appleton wants to join this conversation. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. Your guest had kind of touched on the idea that we're seeing the humanitarian side of athletes. And I just wanted to comment, I am not a sports fan, so my life has not changed dramatically here. But I have a four-year-old that loves any sport, anything that he can do active. I mean, he's just on the go. And we've been watching Harlem Globetrotters on Go Noodle. We watched some of their videos where they do, like, training exercises with the kids. And I think it's really great that this is a way for athletes to really show their loyalty and, you know, give to the next generation, where we know that kids need to be active and we know that, you know, parents are finding different ways to fill in that physical education, you know, criteria for school. So the fact that athletes are taking their time to really fill in that gap is pretty awesome.
Jesse, thank you so much for sharing that perspective. Jason, you know, Jesse and her kid finding some inspiration here in athletes connecting with fans, not just playing on the field.
Absolutely. And she raises another parallel point here, which I think is important, is that we all need to be active right now. You know, we're talking about sports and stadiums and big events and things like that. But all of us, in terms of just, you know, keeping our fitness and keeping our, you know, brains humming along, I think it's important to be active. And whether it's doing jumping jacks and burpees in your living room or running around the house or just doing anything just to get a little bit of fresh air and get your blood going a little bit is really important. So if people are finding inspiration from those kind of training tools that I've seen a number of athletes putting out there, I think that's excellent.
But burpees in your living room.
I should say a burpee, one
okay.
burpee. And I probably didn't
that.
Put my knees. Yeah.
I appreciate it. Dave from Milwaukee also wants to talk with us. Hi, Dave.
I love that burpees are still a thing. Makes me feel young. Dom, or not quite so old. Hey, I was just saying that the playing without fans has been used in Europe for soccer, for football in Europe. Forever, for as punishments to, you know, maybe poor, you know, fighting of the fans or, you know, racist yeah. stuff of the fans. So it's a monetary thing. But as a person watching those games on TV, that itself is a weird experience because you certainly hear all the echo. You know, as a coach, I would tell people, my players, there's a lot of talking that's going on in the field that you have no idea about until you go and sure. play a little bit, and now suddenly you can hear it because you can hear the echoes of these dead, empty stands. I was saying to your screener that I don't see how they have sports and quarantine the players so they're not going home to their families, but I'd love to see them figure it out because I miss sports, I got to say.
All right, Dave. Thanks so much, Dave. Mrs. Sports. And yeah, that idea of a punishment in kind of other avenues being applied just for public safety here, you know, I don't know how that sits right now. What do you think, Jason?
Well, I think what he's saying is that, you know, in European soccer, there have been incidents in the past where they have, you know, inflicted some sort of punishment on a franchise by making them play a game mm-hmm. without fans. And sometimes that's been a public safety concern as well. So that experiment has happened. And what he was saying, and I think is the smart takeaway, is that, you know, you do hear things. You do hear chatter among the players and coaches and things that you're not accustomed to hearing, certainly when there are 20,000 screaming fans in there. I'd be very curious to hear if they actually mic it up so you can hear everything. And I do mean everything. And I mean you might need earmuffs on your children because, you know, some of these professional athletic games can get pretty spicy verbally. But, you know, it will bring a new dynamic to it. And I'm sure that the people in virtually every league are committed to trying to find some sort of, you know, value add, some sort of creative approach to these things that is going to maybe not substitute for the fan energy, but at least make you want to watch a little more of it.
Sure, because it's a matter of retaining the fans and keeping the interest and also, you know, having something for players, for participants to do right now.
I mean, what's going to happen at Camp Randall if they play a football game with no fans and the fourth quarter rolls around, they have to do jump around? What is that? What is that going to be all about? Is it just the players bobbing up and down the bench? I know they do that already, but it's going to be a very surreal experience to watch this kind of thing if it shakes out this way.
Thank you for that parting image. We very much appreciate it, Jason. Thanks for joining us today.
Bye-bye.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist with The Wall Street Journal and, if you didn't realize it, a UW-Madison alum. And we've been talking with him about how we're getting by without sports and when and in what form they might return to us. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a new series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. With record numbers of people unemployed nationwide, the service industry has been hit particularly hard. Madison bartender Amy Moreland has been out of work since mid-March. It's affected her finances and also her mental health.
So my day-to-day life before coronavirus was I was actually just like in a very like a good place, I guess is what I would say. I was thriving. I had quit my job at the bar that I worked at for a very long time. I had quit drinking. I had gotten a new job bartending, but also that came with like a little bit more responsibility, so it was giving me a greater sense of purpose. I was really happy. I was in a really good spot in my life. Like I said, I was thriving. And now I was so living so tightly before that I didn't have a lot of money to, you know, play around with. I think I had about $1,000 in my savings account, which was really hard to get to at that point, like making as little as I did, but it was like what I scrimped and saved. And I was really excited about, I've never, you know, like working in restaurants and bars, I've never had a 401k. So I'm getting to the point at 38 that I've realized that I need to have something like that. And the only way I was going to get it is if I made it for myself. So I started to save this money like really diligently, and I started to make these moves, and it's all gone in the last couple weeks because I don't have any income coming in. I did apply for unemployment, so I get $100 a week to live on through unemployment, which is, you know, whatever. I'm happy they're giving me anything, but it's, I mean, the little money that I was making was not $100 a week. My rent is $1,000 a month. So I've honestly, you know, spent a lot of time on the computer, on Facebook, on doing things that, you know, are not good for me. Not eating particularly well, when I, you know, not eating for a long time. And then when I do, just eating something terrible, like, zebra cakes or, you know, half a pizza. And I mean, 1 month ago, I was going to the gym every single day and like seeing like a trainer and like being on a schedule and entering like being on a really great diet and everything. And now it's like, if I can make myself go outside and take a walk around the block, like it's not a good place to be, I guess is where it is. And what I'm scared of the most now is that I'm not going to be able to get back to the place that I was. I'm scared that this is going to be the new normal. I'm scared about politics, that we're going to start hating our neighbors even more than we already do, like this terrible divide. I'm afraid nothing is ever going to go back to normal, and at the same time, I'm afraid everything is going to go back to exactly the same. And what do I think will be different when this is over? I mean, I think that's part of the scary thing is I don't know what it's the unknown.
This story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, a new series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're talking about how this new coronavirus spreads, why it's so effective at infiltrating and affecting human bodies. hear from a virologist with the University of Wisconsin. We're also talking about birding in Wisconsin. Now that we're sticking closer to home, we have more chances to catch birds at the feeders. We're talking about what kinds we're likely to see in different parts of the state. And board game retailers in Wisconsin are working against the boredom of staying home. We're talking about a personal shopping experience for people looking to pass the time with a little friendly in-house competition. And that's tomorrow on Central Time, plus weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7, we are talking with a researcher who studies contamination in water. Scientists have been sampling private wells in 3 southwestern Wisconsin counties. We'll get an update on that study, and we'll also discuss what the research might tell us about clean water here in Wisconsin. Coming up next, it is the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we find out how our state scores nationally in a report on the state of preschool, especially as we're looking at the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic effects. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is Central Time.